Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect's Bristol's first podcast, set up in 2002 with a grant from the Scarborough Trust. We're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 some Tuesdays when they decide to let us on. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, protests in Gaza over in Israel. Occupied Palestine, some would say. We speak to Wafa al-Udaini, who lives over in Gaza, and also to Rita Kangalusi, who does the Palestine Museum in Broad Street here in Bristol. Also, presenter Richie Allen. He's been doing a radio show for about 3 or 4 years now, but he's just had his channel taken down by YouTube. He's on richieallen.co.uk. And Caroline Stevens, she's a Leave campaigner and now part of something called Unity in Action. She was a UKIP parliamentary candidate. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. We're based at the People's Republic of Stokes Croft on Jamaica Street. And I'll give you our contact details at the end of the show.
The people since 2 weeks are protesting peacefully. They are marching to the border fence and they are protesting peacefully in this area. The Israelis, they open the fire many times against them and they throw like tear gas against them as well. So 31 Palestinians get murdered and more than 2,000 get injured. Some of those who get injured actually by the tear gas, when they smell it at the very beginning, they feel as there is nothing. And then when they go home, their body start to shake and they are trembling. Added to that, they lose their conscious. And a friend of mine, actually, I saw his three brothers. They are trying to stop him from trembling, but they couldn't because he was trembling so strong. And the doctors say that there is no cure for these persons who smell the tear gas by the Israeli, which fired, by the Israeli occupation forces. So I think the Israelis are using prohibited weapon. The doctors say that maybe it's a prohibited weapon, so they have to go outside Gaza to get a treatment, but because of the closure of borders, so they never have a chance to go out, and we don't know exactly what will happen to those people. I know so many British people, and really I like them so much because most of them, they support us, I know that. But in 1948, when we are under the Britain mandate, and then Balfour gave us to the Zionist movement, and they got massacred us. So I'm sure, Balfour and the others are responsible for sure for our misery here, miserable life, for sure. And my message is for the government and for the people, they have to act because they are responsible for our misery. So they have to stop the Israeli occupation from keep going on massacre the people here from the ethnic cleansing.
This is Rita Kangalusi from the Palestine Museum. To listen to Wafa, I got so much feeling for them because I seen some of the picture where the Israelis send drones with the tear gas, and this tear gas have some sort of poison. I'm not sure what it is. And I saw one video of a young boy, a school boy, having some sort of epilepsy, looked like he had epilepsy. And so basically they go to the border, the Palestinian people, they go to the border 700 meters away from the border. And even though quite far from the border, the Israelis send the drones with the tear gas and they have snipers, which they kill already quite lots of people, but they injure so many. Only one day there was 1,600 people injured. And they shoot them in the legs. I can say that when they shoot in the legs, then there would be lots of people looking after one person being shot. So that's how the Israeli try to get.
Okay, so what are we able to do here in Bristol?
I think just campaign, try to contact your MP, supporting the Palestinians. because they're going through quite a lot of hard time. As you know, the prisoners go to prison sometimes or commit any crime, or they have administrative detention, which, you know, they can put in prison for as long as they want. The longest person be in prison for 31 years without any sentence at the end. 27 Broad Street, the Palestine Museum and Cultural Centre. Apparently, we are the only one in UK, so please come. And you can educate yourself on Palestine culture and history and everything else.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
My name is Richie Allen. I make an independent radio show from Manchester, where what I have been doing for about 3.5 years. But I come from a commercial and national radio background in Ireland, where I spent many years working, producing and presenting programmes over there. Had a bit of an epiphany, for want of a better word, in the early 2000s about what I was doing, the rights of it and the wrongs of it. The wrongs of it in terms of the information that maybe wasn't getting out through programmes that I was producing, and began to think kind of long and hard about media and media production and plurality and all those issues.
Okay, so who were you working for, and what sort of issues was there some resistance to broadcasting?
Well, I started off at WLRFM in Ireland, which is one of Ireland's biggest and most successful commercial radio stations. And national and local politics were pretty much covered most days. But things like corruption, Tony, things like local corruption, national corruption, we were precluded from covering this stuff, but we ran up against issues where station management, station owners might have been interfering with the content we could do, the programmes we could do, because of their relationships with some of the people that we might have been trying to question or expose on our program.
It almost sounds like the Max Headroom program, yeah. You know, where you've got that cyberpunk series from the 80s on Channel 4, where you've got the reporter that keeps coming up against his own network. He's trying to do stories on corruption in his own Network 23. And at the end of the day as well, though, I mean, of course, station managers do have to protect the integrity of the station with regard to finance. So if you're saying something about corruption on the radio, you could possibly be liable to be sued afterwards.
Well, this is really important. I mean, commercial radio stations live and die by advertising revenue and advertising sales. And some of the stuff in Waterford City, where the station is based, that we were doing would have put the station manager and the head of sales, the head of advertising, under a bit of pressure. And I can totally understand that. Look, I'm older and wiser than I was then. When I was a bit younger, I was more inclined to swear and to criticise and not see it from their angle as well. But it was one particular story that we didn't cover that was unforgivable. And it was a story of massive corruption that was happening in our town. And the national tabloids were very interested in it. And we were basically told, my presenter and I, whom I filled in for when he was on holidays, we were told, you can't do this because we just don't want to be doing it. And it was a major story, and it kind of broke my heart, really, because I was very naive at that time.
Well,
I really
can you believe... tell us a bit more about that story now? You know, what was going on?
I can tell you
on?
A little bit about it. Waterford is a beautiful old Viking city, and it's situated on a river, the River Shure. And there was a riverfront property, a commercial property, and it would have been one of the most expensive properties to buy if it ever went up for sale. It would have been one of the most valuable commercial properties because of its location. And it was owned by a family that was beloved by the city, because they ran a furniture shop there. They were very kind to people. They allowed poor people buy furniture, Tony, on the never, never, as we would say, you know, credit forever kind of a thing. They were lovely people. And not to put too fine a point on it or to spend too much time talking about it, he came to us one day and he was in a desperate state, And he told us a story that we found hard to believe, but when we looked into it, it was true. He had been jesting with his estate agent on the golf course after a few drinks. And he had said to his estate agent that he was considering possibly selling this key front, amazing commercial property. Anyway, he was surprised a few weeks later to get a letter in the post basically saying that the sale was going through. This is crazy stuff now. Effectively, his estate agent had gone and sold the property without his consent, with no contracts, to a notorious businessman whose name I'm not going to mention here or anywhere else, without the actual written consent of the property owner. And this was upheld in the Irish courts. That is not a joke. I mean, it's unbelievable corruption. And we uncovered a conspiracy to basically get the property out of his hands and his family's hands, and yet we couldn't go to air with it. At some stage later on, some of the national tabloids flirted with it and talked about it, but not too much. And it kind of broke my heart, that, because I really was naive. I really thought that we were, you know, changing the world.
But, I mean,
we were.
Surely Ireland has got its own kind of version of Private Eye, somewhere where you can get these stories out. I mean, quite a lot of journalists do that, don't they? If they can't, if their boss is telling them, no, you can't, you can always turn to somebody like Private Eye to get the story.
Tony, you've heard of a man called Dennis O'Brien, haven't you?
Yeah.
Well, he owns my country now. And that's lock, stock and barrel. That's the media. That's everything. And by the time this was going on when I started out, Tony, we were seeing happen in Ireland what happened here with Global Media and Bear Media. Our stations were being bought up. And, you know, good commercial stations that were local. I mean, ours was kind of commercial stroke national. We had, you know, we had listeners in Waterford and Cork and South Kilkenny and Tipperary and Wexford. We were very big. But they were being bought up by, in fact, a lot of stations were bought up by a company that had links to Bob Geldof, or Geldof had big shares in it. So we just basically saw plurality just die on its backside.
Well, that's worrying, isn't it? I mean, Geldof, I know, was on RTE the other day saying that he thought that the Easter Rising was a waste of time. You know, so that's the kind of character that's owning your national media. You really do have something to worry about in Ireland. So what you're saying effectively is there was no other way to get this story out.
No, there wasn't. No, our managing director said that, you know, he was known to some of the parties involved, and that he would basically prefer that we didn't cover the story. What was interesting about it was, and I don't want to come down too hard on our managing director either, what was interesting was we recorded an interview with the victim and presented it to our own in-house solicitor, and he said it's fine. So it should have went to air, but it didn't. And, you know, look, you're getting one side of this, of course. My former employees, and this is like 15, 16, 17, 18 years ago, they're not here to give their side of it. They might have a different side of it. I just thought, you know, it was the kind of thing we should have been covering. It wouldn't have won me or my presenter the Pulitzer Prize, but it would have kind of scored a point. It would have scored a victory for, you know, the local businessman, the small businessman.
Well, also, against, I mean, one know, of the things we love to do as journalists is, yeah, is to champion the underdog in a situation,
yeah,
like that.
Absolutely.
I mean, I'm just going to briefly explain what happened with me in a similar sort of situation when I was working for the BBC in Salisbury in Wiltshire, which was that we'd uncovered some evidence of the vice chair of the local Conservative Party, two children's homes, which he ran, and that there was child abuse going on there in there, and that this had been flagged up to the people running those children's homes and nothing had been done about it. So we had all that sort of evidence. And the problem is, you know, you can sometimes you can interview people. This exactly is the sort of thing that happened with the Jimmy Savile case and Liz McKean at Newsnight, is you've got interviews on the record where people have literally put their lives on the line with you, and then you have to go back to them and say, oh, yes, but our network won't broadcast this. I'm really sorry.
Yeah, that's a terrible thing. Anybody who's ever produced or presented commercial radio has had that experience. It's a dreadful thing to get somebody, as you said, Tony, to put themselves maybe in jeopardy. Maybe they go to places emotionally they don't really want to go, but they do because it's the right thing to do. And then you find out you can't air it. It's a difficult thing. And it did definitely have a lot to do with me resigning my position as, you know, you know, the senior talk producer at that station. And I did leave of my own volition. I left with great references. But I felt it was very wrong. And of course, it was probably a good thing in the sense that I did begin to start questioning everything. And I did begin to look at media ownership. And I did begin to look at how certain stories were covered. You know, the big terrorist attacks of the early 2000s. September 11th, I came to you and to your work through seeing your investigations of the 7th of July. And I think what happened to me was very good, because I think previously I would have been some people might say I'm still arrogant. I don't think I'm very arrogant, but certainly I was when I was younger. And I would have looked at real investigative journalists like yourself, and I probably would have been very dismissive of you. And, you know, very arrogant and pompous and look at that conspiracy nonsense. But I learned a lot from my experiences and, you know, saw that you're seeing maybe 1% on Sky News, BBC Channel 4, you're getting 1 to maybe 2% of the real overall story, and all the facts are certainly not in. And I learned a lot through those experiences, and kind of thank God for them, really.
Well, what do you make of the internet? Because I think maybe we're in a stage just about still now where we've got almost like the golden age of the internet, rather like they had with television in the 1960s, 1970s and early 80s. There was some fantastic drama produced on television, really good investigative journalism from people like Duncan Campbell, looking into the secret societies, the state, Martin Short looking into a long documentary series on ITV, looking into the Freemasons and their infiltration of public offices. This kind of thing was going on TV. I guess it's the internet now.
Absolutely. And again, without the internet, I wouldn't have found you, because I was in Spain when I found you. We hadn't been in Spain very long. And we'd been in Manchester for a couple of years. Then we went to Spain for a long time. And it was while I was there that I found your work, and I was able to look into that and see what you were doing and cross-reference what you were saying and others with facts that I was able to find out again by using the internet. Absolutely. And I think you've hit the nail on the head. We're in the golden age of it. It's a brilliant time to be talking about the internet, Tony, because I think with everything we're seeing about you know, bringing in Facebook and Twitter to speak before Parliament and before Congress, and all this talk about how we're going to have to clean up debate online. I think those that would prefer that free speech just went away and that we didn't openly and, you know, fairly throw everything out there for everybody to see, there's definitely, as far as I can see now, a real effort. And I think it's an effort that's being joined by governments all around the world to try and kind of tamper down or kind of close down that kind of internet freedom. I think it might be the golden age now, but I think what's coming in terms of whether it's, you know, through net neutrality or through government saying, well, we can't have people trolling each other online, we can't have people saying things online that are wrong, all this fake news nonsense, Tony, these inquiries. I think we've got to be very careful in the next couple of years, lest we lose this great platform that we have to share information.
Okay, well, before we get on to talking about some current stories, one of the things which really seriously worries me is the demonetization at YouTube. So that is to say that freelance investigative journalists cannot actually make money anymore if they're doing really good stories on YouTube. And we saw this event, didn't we, at YouTube recently with this creator Nassim Agdam, who apparently was making YouTube films on animal rights, looking at some of the horrendous conditions that animals are put through, and she was getting a lot of hits on YouTube and therefore was making money, and she was able to actually make a living making these until YouTube then decided to demonetize all her videos, and she decided to get her own back by turning up at Mountain View, California YouTube headquarters and starting to shoot people. Now this is really, I suppose, you know, of course it's not right to shoot people, but it's indicative of what is effectively a kind of close down of income for people doing things like you and I are doing.
My YouTube channel was deleted 9 weeks ago. Now, listen, I have a big beef with the independent media, or some of it. There's a lot of it I don't like, because there's a lot of virtue signalling. There's a lot of pretend journalists who really just try to insert themselves into the story. They become the story. You know who I'm talking about. I'm not going to mention any names. So when I say I was kicked off YouTube, I'm not looking for any sympathy. I'm not claiming that I was personally attacked. I certainly was not personally attacked. But we had a YouTube channel that we had managed to build into 85,000 subscribers. We'd had over 22 million views in 3 years. And for a time, we were bringing in a grand or a grand and a half a month, which was helping to pay for our overheads. And I wasn't doing anything reckless with the channel, because all the channel featured was me speaking with people like yourself, investigative journalists, or people that had something different to say that couldn't get to say that on national TV or radio. So we put all the interviews on there, every single one of them. And, you know, there was never anything distasteful on any of my programs. Nobody was ever libeled. Nobody was ever wronged. There was no harmful content. It was just different opinions. And all of a sudden, within a week, there were three community guidelines warnings, and they deleted the channel. Deleted it, gone. And I was very polite with them. I contacted them. I said, look, this is grossly unfair. You're giving me community strikes for videos that have been up there for 3 years. And in those videos, which were about Sandy Hook and Connecticut and other things, I am vociferously challenging my interviewee. I'm having a right go at them. It's proper, you know, presenting.
Yeah,
you know,
I'm not just sitting there. It's balanced rather
it's
than...
It's balanced, Tony, exactly. Yeah. But YouTube said, no, under no circumstances are you getting it back. So fair enough. So we put another one up there, and we're just putting the interviews up now. But yeah, they won't allow us to monetize it. And it is frustrating, and it is wrong, because independent shows like ours, you know, we obviously struggle to generate the kind of advertising that we would need to sustain us because of the nature of the things we talk about.
What I'm saying is it sort of signifies to me maybe the beginning of the end of the internet as a useful platform for investigative journalism. But anyway, look, let's get on to some of the other stories that are around at the moment. For example, we've had over the last few weeks, we've had this Salisbury incident, as well as the airstrikes by France, US and Britain on Syria. What do you make of those?
I'm stunned. I mean, we talk about the media. I mean, you know all about Salisbury and Wiltshire. Tony, I remember after Chilcot reported a couple of years ago, there were several articles in several broadsheet newspapers where journalists were very contrite, and they apologised for their conduct in the lead up to the Iraq war, and kind of insisted that or promised that we would never see that sort of collusion again. Well, my God, Tony, it's worse this time around. I was listening to Sky News today, and there was a Labour politician on, Christopher, what's his name? He's the one that's very sympathetic to Corbyn. His name will come to me in a second. I've probably got it written down here because I've been on air myself this evening. Well, basically, he was saying that he was listening to Major General Jonathan Shaw, who was rushed off Sky News last Friday when he attempted to say that he couldn't understand why the Assad government would want to use chemical weapons as the Islamist terrorists are on their retreat. But we're looking at politics. We're looking at people basically being treated. It's almost like McCarthyism. If you suggest that, well, it doesn't make much sense that Assad would do that, number one. Or number two, well, let's wait till the OPCW men and women go in before we come to any conclusion. You're almost labelled as a kind of a commie traitor or anti-government kind of traitor or conspiracy theorist. And I saw this today again on Sky News. It was quite amazing. They were talking about anti-Semitism in the Labour Party. And one of Corbyn's allies was saying, well, you know, again, a lot of the stuff that's online is stuff that's put out there by trolls to make the party look like it's anti-Semitic. It's not all genuine stuff. And then he was lampooned and lambasted because he basically said that, well, no, I wouldn't have bombed Syria. I would have waited until we got... Chris Williamson it is, Tony. I would have waited until we actually got some evidence. And Nicky Morgan, the former education secretary, was sitting alongside him. And she basically accused him of treachery, Tony. Well, what's happening, Tony?
Well, I'll tell you what's happening. It's Rupert Murdoch's empire. It's a bit like you had in Ireland, Richie, really.
Yeah.
Rupert Murdoch is a major investor in this Genie oil company, which has got concessions in the Golan Heights. And it's got a personal, private, multi-billion dollar interest in the Syrian civil war, because what it does is for people that don't know, the Golan Heights is actually part of Syria, but it was stolen by the Israelis in the October War. I think it was the Yom Kippur War, about 1974. And the Israelis said, we need this area as a buffer zone. And so the idea of a Syrian civil war is actually mother's milk to Rupert Murdoch, who then, if the Golan Heights is secured by Israel, as it is slowly being, and the civil war has really helped that, suddenly he's quids in. So I guess it's the same sort of thing, isn't it? You know, you've got personal connections and private reasons why you're allowing a certain narrative to go out on your channel and not another one.
100% right, Tony. And we saw that last Friday when former commander of British forces in Iraq was basically given the bum's rush off Sky News by a presenter called Samantha Washington, because he dared suggest Major General Jonathan Shaw that I don't understand why a man who's winning the war, who's nearly won the war effectively because of the support he's generated from Russia, why he would then decide to use chlorine gas or weapons on his own.
I know,
people.
The most amazing,
makes no sense.
Amazing thing about that was this guy was the senior British commander in Iraq.
Yes.
He served in Bosnia, served all over the world, and yet Tony. I actually engaged with one of the Sky people who said he was sitting in the TV station actually watching all this at the time, and he said, "Oh well, it was just a matter of timing." And so I said to him, "Well, couldn't you have brought him back after the ad break?" And no. But anyway, they are closing down, and it's also interesting to see the extent to which Rupert Murdoch's channel's been involved in all of this. I think, you know, the BBC actually, you know, has been doing a better job, not a good job, but a better job. And we've seen really no tracking of the hard evidence from people like Robert Fisk, who've actually been in there, who's one of Britain's most award-winning journalists. I mean, he says he won't go on to the BBC or anyone else because they say, "We want to know exactly what you're going to say before you come on." And he said, "Well, I don't know what I'm going to say." And he's not prepared to do it. So there are still some journalists with integrity around who are simply not prepared to play some sort of silly game. But anyway, look, one of the subjects both you and I have looked at quite closely over the years is this one of child sexual abuse, which I suppose was blown open by the Jimmy Savile death and the subsequent, you know, there's no more legal excuses by the broadcasters then to not publish the truth about Jimmy Savile, because up until then that was the regular thing that we heard from broadcast managers, broadcast lawyers: "Oh, we can't say anything bad about Jimmy Savile because he might sue us." Well, then the journalist might say back to them, "Yes, but then he might lose," but they weren't prepared to take that risk. But after he was dead, there was no more possibility of libel action, so that's when it all came out. But what do you think that whole post Savile story has meant for Britain, and where are we now with it?
It's a really good question, Tony, because I wonder about the inquiry that's had several chairpersons. And, you know, we could spend a long time now, you and I, talking about how the current Prime Minister maybe should be, well, she should have been interviewed under caution for appointing Elizabeth Butler-Sloss and Fiona Wolfe to that inquiry, both of whom with serious ties to men who have been accused of sexual abuse. I don't know where it is, Tony. You see, you hoped once the Savile stuff came out, and, you know, we know people. I have been associated closely over the years with David Icke, and David had the courage. David was talking about Savile when he was alive. David was talking about Edward Heath when he was alive. And the hope was that it would be like a house of cards coming tumbling down. But it hasn't proven to be that at all. You know, a lot of what I find happening, or what I see happening, especially the last 12 to 18 months, is that some of the newspapers that were very keen to write about it, to look into it, to talk about it, they've now almost kind of gone either indifferent to it, Tony, or they've begun to do stories about how the victims are fantasists. And I'm not saying that some of them are not. I'm not saying that some people haven't told lies. But I wonder about the inquiry. It's remind me, Tony, who's heading it up now? It's not Lowell Goddard. She went home.
That's right. Well, she left in interesting circumstances. Lowell Goddard back to New Zealand. Because she was basically bullied out, and yet she was told to sign some sort of gagging clause, which meant that she wasn't allowed to say why she had had to leave. This is the sort of trick that the Home Office play. I think one of the biggest problems is it's the Home Office who are implicated in this scandal over the last 30, 40, 50 Absolutely. Years, and yet the Home Office who are organising the inquiry. So it's Alexis J.
Alexis now, J, no, that's right.
Who's the chair. Problem being that she was presided over this inquiry in Rotherham and didn't find any fault of any public servants, any social workers or police, certainly didn't recommend any kind of prosecution of the people that allowed this to go on for literally for decades, with literally scores or hundreds of cases reported to the police. I mean, it seems to me like the most incredible perversion of the course of justice by the officials who have been involved in this inquiry, including, you know, lawyers working for the Home Office, etc.
But you will know all about Maggie Oliver in Rochdale, the former detective. I was lucky enough to interview Maggie and speak to her and also speak to her off air. And Maggie Oliver contends to this day that it was the Home Office that suppressed the investigation into grooming in Rochdale. It was the Home Office. She's absolutely certain of that. The police have been blamed, and MPs have talked about the police's reluctance to be getting involved in terms of they might be accused of racism or picking on the minority community there. But she says no, that it was coming from the Home Office.
Finally, can we trust Facebook? Can we trust Twitter?
I got the message. Did you? I got the kind of half apology message. I'm sure you'll get one sooner or later. I've got it here very briefly. What does it say? We understand the importance of keeping your data safe. We have banned an app because one of your friends logged into it and some of your data was misused. We're sorry, Facebook, kind of a thing. Tony, how can I talk to you about this? You know, I think you have a far better grasp of social media than I do. But look, it was a wonderful thing. Introduce this thing. It took over from Friends Reunited. Meet people, share your data, put your pictures up there, keep in touch with your friends and family. Tony, it was a con job from day one. It was always about getting people to basically sell their souls, give every detail, minute, important, unimportant detail of themselves to a company.
But it's a powerful tool, isn't it? Most young people get all of their news and information from social media. They don't ever watch television, most young people these days.
No, because they'll see clips of their favourite shows on Facebook. They'll see their favourite shows on Facebook and on YouTube. You're absolutely right, Tony. I'm very interested in what Cambridge Analytica might have been able to do or might not have been able to do, and whether they were able to influence people or not. I am open-minded. But look, there is a concerted effort to destroy the Brexit vote, of course, and there is a concerted effort to destroy Trump. Not that I'm any supporter or fan of Donald Trump at all. I'm not. I have no interest in him or anybody else. I don't have any interest in democracy. I don't believe in democracy. But I just wonder how much they could use people's data to actually influence their decision-making when it comes to voting.
Okay,
hang on. I'm not sure about that.
You just dropped that in there. You've had enough of democracy.
Well, yes,
it's a principle.
Because
it's a principle,
the
isn't it? Isn't it the principle that the people are in charge, and whatever mechanism it might be? Obviously, there's problems with that, but the principle is quite an important one, surely.
It is, but it doesn't work, Tony, does it? It doesn't work because you and I are both precluded from running because we don't have the money to run. We're precluded from running because massive corporations are not going to give us the money we need to run. There is no such thing as democracy. Regardless of which party is in, left or right, liberal or conservative, it's the same thing. More wars, you know, more crazy incursions overseas that kill millions and millions of people.
Well, I think Jeremy Corbyn might disagree with you, although there's quite a lot of Blairites that wouldn't. Anyway, how do people follow you online?
Just go to my website, richieallen.co.uk. There's no T in Richie, richieallen.co.uk. And thanks so much for honouring me with the invite, Tony. And I mean that. I'm not paying lip service to that. Nobody offers me or invites me to do anything. So I'm absolutely privileged to be on with you. Thanks so much for the invitation.
Okay, so
richieallen.co.uk.
And has that got a link to your YouTube too?
Yeah, it's all on there on the homepage. Yeah.
Fantastic, Richie. Lovely to speak to you.
Cheers, Tony.
All the best.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Hi, Tony. My name's Caroline Stevens. I'm the Brexit spokesman for a new political party called Unity in Action.
Okay, Unity in Action does sound a bit, well, it could be anything almost. Why have you chosen that title?
We want to unify the country. We see that the country is very divided at the moment, and we need to bring people together after the referendum vote in particular.
But, I mean, surely that division has always been there and will always be there. I mean, it's been most obvious amongst the political parties, but the division in society has always been there. In fact, actually, it was quite clear at the referendum that it is almost a 50-50 split between people that think that it's a good idea to be part of Brussels and people like you that think the opposite.
Well, there were 17.4 million people voted for Brexit, so that's a starting point. We were very
conscious. And 17.3 against?
No, it wasn't. There was over a million difference, Tony.
The country was quite divided, wasn't it? I mean, we know with the Brexit vote 2 years ago that it was roughly 50-50.
If you call 50-50, 52-48%, we had over a million people more voting for Brexit than the Remain side. But what we want to do now is to heal those wounds, bring people together and show them that actually we should be focusing on what our government is doing or not doing. We're concerned now about the establishment. So we've got a rally organised for the 28th of April and we want to bring people together and explain that our government is trying to deport people who came into this country on their family's passports in the 1960s. And that's, you know, we want to highlight now the inequalities in our society. So the leader of our party is a chap called Winston McKenzie. He used to be a Commonwealth spokesman. He actually himself...
For UKIP?
Yes, it was. Yes, he was for UKIP. And he is now vying to become Mayor of London. So the focus on the party is London seats initially and his mayoral contest. Plus, me being the Brexit spokesman, I want to make sure that we can unite so many people together, not just Brexiteers. We want to show people that in actual fact, our government is trying to basically integrate our military with the other EU countries?
Well, I mean, I've just been reading a few weeks ago that the military has decided not to do that, that it's actually separating from... There was an attempt to have a European army and the British military, around about 3 weeks or so ago, said, no, we're not going to be going through that process. So maybe you can bring us up to date.
Yeah, I mean, the EU's going to be in control of our military training. They're going to be in control of our procurement budget, and so it runs on.
Can you just give us some reference for this? Because I mean, as far as I know, as part of the leaving the European Union, much of this military liaison is going to stop. For example, literally a couple of years ago, I saw a load of French troops driving down a motorway here in up the M5. That sort of thing is all going to end. That's what I understood.
Unfortunately, that's not the case. I mean, that was cooperation. We've a lot of the countries, 25 out of the 28 countries, have signed something called the Permanent Structured Cooperation, which is actually military integration with the 25 countries. We also are party to many of the pointers in that treaty.
I mean, hasn't UKIP really sort of had its day? I mean, you've had your referendum, we voted to leave, and UKIP and the people who are really part of the Leave campaign, I mean, for example, standing as a Mayor of London, it's just simply a no-brainer. Surely there's no chance of any kind of success in parliamentary or mayoral politics or locally, really.
Why do you say... I don't understand why you say that, because we haven't got Brexit. The actual fact that Winston wants to go for for mayor. We've got knife crime on the increase. We have so much crime in London now over the past couple of years. Our police services are being cut to the bone. And, you know, there's been a leaked report from the weekend saying how our police cuts have had a direct impact on the crime. And the idea of our parliament, the idea of a mayor, they're supposed to protect the people.
Caroline, I'm going to ask you the same question I'd ask anybody on this, is how are you going to pay for it? Because that's the reason we're given by both Labour and Conservative that it's difficult to pay for police, or the reason we have to cut the police and all of the other public services, is because there simply isn't the money anymore. I mean, we know, you can see shops closing on the high streets. Bristol is actually not very lively, apart from maybe on a Friday night or a Saturday night. People just don't have the spare cash to spend, and neither does the government. So where are you going to produce this magic money tree which is going to pay for all these new police?
Well, for a start, we've had a cross group of peers in the House of Lords came up with a report a year ago that said our government did not need to pay any more money to the EU. But yet Theresa May is still talking about a divorce settlement. We don't have to pay that. That money in itself would make inroads into the expenditure that we need to make for our country. And the military union, if we're going to be asked to pay for our military budget and we're going to have to direct it through to Brussels, we want to be in control of our own military. We want to be in charge of our own procurement. And it's our government that's extended this Brexit situation by implementing a transition period, which I don't know if you saw, Tony, at the weekend, but there were protests up and down the country from, where was it, Newcastle, Hull, Plymouth, Portsmouth and Hastings. And all the fishermen are up in arms because it's our government that is kicking the can of Brexit down the road. And our fishermen want to take back control of our fishing waters.
Can you just clear up what's happening here? As far as I understood, once we leave the EU, we're back in control of our territorial waters and we will actually start to see a fishing industry start growing again.
But one of our red lines in Unity in Action is by the end of March next year, the fishermen must have control of their waters back. Our government has planned for this not to be the case. And there are new regulations coming in during the transition period which preclude our fishermen's industry from flourishing. And a lot more boats will be burnt. We saw boats being burnt on Whitstable and Hastings at the weekend. And our fishermen will be doing a lot more of that. And of course, you probably saw a couple of weeks ago some of the politicians throwing fish back into the Thames. Well, our fishermen have been doing that for 40-odd years. I mean, it's a scandal when you consider all the homelessness, the food banks, that, as you said, you know, people are strapped for cash. And we don't throw fish back in the waters.
But that's the same right across the European Union, isn't it? In Spain, it's horrendous youth homelessness. Italy, just the same. Greece, just the same.
So why would you want to tie yourself to a sinking ship? Would you sink with the Titanic? Wouldn't you want to flourish and do those trade deals with the rest of the world?
What about open borders? Because this is one of the things which I think is most important in many people's minds who voted for Brexit, not in a racist sense, but simply because they can see that migrants, economic migrants, have been coming in as cheap labour, and actually the most powerful people in the country, the big corporations, seem to be more powerful than the government. Often they've got more money than the government.
That's true.
They seem to just want to have cheap migrant labour.
Absolutely true.
So what's happening with the open borders?
The government has kicked that down into the long grass as well. And so this transition period will then run into the next general election. And of course, the next parliament is not bound by this parliament. So they could easily turn around and say, right, we're going to stay into the EU. But of course, you see, they played blinder, did the Remainers, because they had a court case at the beginning of this year, if you recall, and they said that Parliament was sovereign. Now, let's have this, you know, recorded on your radio station. Parliament is not sovereign. The people are sovereign.
Well, actually, the Queen might disagree with you there.
No, the people are sovereign. The people have the power and we need to take back control. That was what Vote Leave used to say on the bus, wasn't it? Take back control. So the people now need to take back control, because we can see that it doesn't matter whether you have a government that's Tory or a government that's Labour. They're all, as you said a few minutes ago, that they're run by big business.
Well, I'm not saying that necessarily all of them are run. They certainly have a big influence over the political parties through donations. But, I mean, really, you're a tiny little minnow in this sea of sharks, aren't you?
17.4 million people voted for Brexit, and a lot of those people who voted Remain say to me now, they didn't know that we were going to have military unification. They didn't know that we were going to lose all our fish to Brussels, because what will happen in the transition period with these new rules, if the nation state cannot catch their fish that we've been catching already, in actual fact, the other 27 countries will divvy our fish out. We will not have a fishing industry left at all.
I mean, a large part of sovereignty surely must point at the Queen, at Prince Charles. What's been their role in all this? Or are they just sort of back in the back seat?
Tony, that is a brilliant question. And I'm glad you asked that. Because in 2001, the Queen was petitioned. A group of barons got together, 25 barons got together, because they were concerned about the Treaty of Nice.
These are lowly barons, so they're very low down the aristocracy, aren't they? They're not dukes or anything.
Anybody can petition the Queen. But the barons petitioned the Queen in connection with the Magna Carta of 1215, which cannot be amended by any parliament. And they petitioned the Queen. They said they were concerned about signing the Treaty of Nice, because the trouble was, at that time, the government was trying to whip them to vote for open borders, and the barons didn't want that. They didn't feel that was in the best interests of the people. So four of them trotted off to see the Queen, and the Queen had 40 days to respond. And on the 39th day, she responded, but it wasn't helpful at all, wasn't her response, shall we put it that way. And we all have the right to, under Magna Carta, to sign our Article 61 oaths. It's not a myth. If we can get enough people together and have that people's army back, working together against the establishment, we can take back control.
Sounds like you're planning some sort of insurrection here.
Ooh, have you been checking my Facebook account?
Are you? Are you,
ooh,
planning, are you planning an insurrection?
I know there are serious events being planned for this year, but not by myself.
Well, what do you say to people who say, well, all this stuff about open borders, actually, it's racist?
Racist?
It's a sort of covert racism, like dog whistle racism. So even though you say you're not racist, there are actually, what the actions are effectively is racist, because you're saying actually it's these people without British passports we don't want here anymore.
That's why we're holding a rally to make sure those people are not deported. These people came over from, especially in the Commonwealth in the beginning, in the 60s. Winston himself came over when he was five on his brother's passport. They all came over on family passports. That was the norm. That was perfectly legal. That's how it was done in those days. And of course, if you don't go abroad, you don't need a passport. So a lot of people still have not got a passport. And now the government is rushing through legislation to ensure that these people can be deported.
Okay, why are they doing that? Why are they doing that?
Good question. That's what I'd like to know. But we're not going to allow that to happen.
Well, why do you think they're doing it?
Well, it's strange, isn't it, when we have open door borders and we've had people living in this country for 40, 50, 60 years, paid their taxes all their lives, they've got their own children and grandchildren. Why is the government doing it? I'd love somebody to ring in to the show and tell me why the government's doing that when we're still a part of the EU.
Well, you're Caroline Stevens and you're on Facebook, I imagine. Where, how can people find you on there if they want to comment on your Facebook?
They can comment. Well, actually, no, because it's a closed account. But we've got a website. We've got a website called OperationBeacon.com. Simply operationbeacon.com. You can email the website. There's plenty of really interesting information on there about you know, the barons, we've just been touching about that, how to sign your Article 61 oath, which is ever so important, and then we're accepting photocopies or photographs of your signed Article 61 oaths. We're putting our army together.
You also worked for Arron Banks as part of the Leave EU campaign, which was successful, based here in Bristol. Tell us a bit about what that experience was like over the, I suppose, a year or so of campaigning. Was it 6 months or how long was it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I was working for Leave EU, and then just before Vote Leave got the designation, I went to work for them remotely, as it were, because they're based in London. Yeah, it was great to actually work back in Bristol, where I used to work years ago. But the traffic's got so much worse, hasn't it?
Well, that's deliberate, actually, because they're trying to get a congestion charge here.
Well, I used to go across on the motorway, so you didn't have to go through the centre. So would you still have a congestion charge then, would you?
They are going to do, yeah, they're trying to bring one in, basically.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, that's why I think that for example, Metrobus has been brought in, which is going to make almost no difference, and in fact has made things more congested in the centre. I mean, it's a conspiracy, it seems quite obvious to me, to create congestion so that you can then charge people to come in and out, and you've got a whole load of money that people never used to have to pay before. Anyway.
Well, actually, you were saying about open door borders, and of course this has going to have impact on the traffic. We've now got reports saying that in the next few years it's actually going to be quicker to cycle through London and cities like Bristol than it is to actually take the car or the bus.
Also, I mean, there's a sort of, I suppose, bound to be problems with the leaving the European Union. It's a bit like, you get married very easily. It was all happening very easily in the 1970s. Now it's divorce time. It's always going to be messy.
It doesn't have to be like that. It could be amicable. We just want to work with other countries as well, to sign our own trade deals, have autonomy. You can't, it's like having, as you say, it's like a marriage, but somebody else is spending all your money and telling you how you to spend your own money back. I want autonomy over the way I spend my money, and the EU were giving us some money back, but they were telling us how it was to be spent. So you can see the roads situation, but yet you've got fantastic roads in Eastern Europe and airports, but yet we're struggling with the roads and our infrastructure in this country. So we want to take back control, take stock of the situation and make this country a pleasanter place for everybody.
Well, that would be nice, but to carry on your motoring analogy, isn't the whole process of leaving the European Union going to be a car crash?
No, Tony, it's really positive. We're going to get our fishing waters back so long as we put pressure on the government. The fishermen will not stop. They're already planning more protests. Then we will have the military situation, which we need to get this out to the rest of Bristol and hopefully further afield, because it is difficult to comprehend that our government, on the one hand, on the mainstream media, is saying that we're going to take back control. And as you said, you mentioned about that report the other week. But yet, on the other hand, we know that the military are very, very worried about the situation.
Quite appropriate that you're in Wiltshire then, I suppose.
With lots of barracks around?
Yes, lots of them there, yeah. Okay, so can you just remind us whereabouts we can follow Unity in Action and online?
You can follow Winston McKenzie on Facebook, and we're putting stuff at the moment on operationbeacon.com website, and then we'll be transferring to the Unity in Action webpage very shortly.
Okay, Caroline Stevens from Unity in Action, Brexit spokesperson or spokesman, as you said.
Spokesman. We're not politically correct.
Okay. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony.
That's all for this week. Dialects Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. You can download it to listen on your phone or in the car. You can subscribe and listen the week before broadcast if you like at dialectradio.co.uk. Thanks to our guests, Wafa Al-Udaini, Rita Kangalusi from the Palestine Museum here in Bristol, Richie Allen, and also former UKIP parliamentary candidate Caroline Stevens, now part of a party called Unity in Action. Also thanks to studio engineer Dave Bazanko. Dialects of Bristol Broadband Co-op production, You can catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 some Tuesdays when the technical side is working, and anyone can contribute to this programme. You can contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897. They're online at prsc.org.uk. You can volunteer with us or for hundreds of opportunities elsewhere in Britain, if you've got the time, via the National Volunteering website. That's do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now.
The show.